Hey there, Richard Serrett here, and I am humbled and honored that you would allow me into your home, your pickup truck, your earbuds, that space between your ears. I had a great time hanging out with you last night, and a number of callers mentioned, of course, this remarkable story of baby Lily, and if you don't know what the story, get the from out under that rock. Baby Lily miraculously survived 14 hours suspended inside an overturned car, half submerged in the frigid rivers of Spanish Forks, Utah. Police have now released a body cam video of officers and first responders lifting that car flipped into the river. And I've been watching that video over and over all day. I am absolutely transfixed, and who wouldn't be? 18-month-old Lily wasn't moving when rescuers found her. And we see in this body cam video, Officer Jared Warner dashing with 18-month-old, the 18-month-old baby in his arms to an ambulance. She's barely alive. Lily's mother, of course, Lynn Jennifer Grosbeck, died in the crash that landed her car on its roof in the Spanish Fork River. She was 25. And Lily might have died unseen with her mother had a man not gone fishing in that particular spot Saturday. So much serendipity here. It's remarkable. The angler waded into the river around noon, then noticed the car wheels up in the water. He called emergency dispatch. Now, the night before, a man who was living nearby heard a loud crash, stepped outside to check. He saw nothing unusual, and he dismissed it. That was 10:30 Friday night. Grosbeck's car had probably just struck a bridge embankment. That's the sound he heard. The angler, the fisherman, came around 12:30 on Saturday, 14 hours later. Now, here's the mystery. Police officers who entered the water say they heard a voice calling for help, keeping in mind the mother was dead. But the officers said they heard an adult's voice calling to them. Quote, "The four of us heard a distant voice coming from the car," Jared Warner told CNN. "To me, it sounded like a child's voice." The voice gave the rescuers a surge of adrenaline needed to push the vehicle upright, he said. The mother was dead, the child unconscious, but her eyelids were fluttering, and the rescuers knew she was alive. And of course, we're seeing this blow by blow in this remarkable video. It's one of the things that doesn't have an explanation, Warner said about the voice. It felt like I could hear someone telling me, I need help. DeWitt told CNN affiliate KSL. This was a witness. It was very surreal, something I felt like I could hear. Tyler Beddoes, a third officer at the scene, said the same. Corroborating evidence. Someone said, help me, inside the car, he said. Remember, the mother is dead. Lily is 18 months old. They heard an adult's voice. Now, here's the thing about the miracle of baby Lily and that voice calling for help. In 48 hours, you know the mainstream media will have moved on. They will have forgotten about that mysterious, miraculous voice. But Coast to Coast will still be here. We won't forget. And you, faithful, courageous souls who listen to this show, won't forget. Because that's why you come to this program. And that's why this program exists. Because we believe, we know, that there's much, much more to that mysterious voice that called out and saved baby Lily. That's the story. That's the takeaway. That's what we hold on to and pursue, even when everyone else has moved on. This is a remarkable story. I've watched the video, as I say, a number of times. It's a miracle. And the people that heard that voice, they know. I believe they heard the voice of an angel. Just before showtime, a gentleman named Robert Dunn sent me an email of a video shot mid-afternoon Thursday, March 12th in Pittsburgh. It's been posted on YouTube. Rob shot this, I believe it was Rob who shot it, waiting for confirmation. He shot it on a 3G cell phone camera in the negative format, and the video reportedly shows a massive celestial body to the left of the sun. And in the email, Rob is suggesting this object, with its size and mass, matches the description of a brown dwarf dragging seven planets in a debris field along with it. Of course, we're talking about Nibiru, Planet X, which is said to be four times the mass of Jupiter. Of course, Jupiter is the largest planet in our solar system. I'm trying to get a hold of Rob to find out if he's the one who posted this, and I'd like to get an astronomer to take a look at this video and tell me what that object might be. Is it Nibiru, Planet X? I don't know. But it's there. It appears to be heading this way like a harbinger, a telltale sign. And speaking of harbingers and signs, Carl Gallups, a former law enforcement official from Florida, now a best-selling author, broadcaster, senior pastor in North Florida. He's been on Coast before. He's standing by and will join us in about an hour to discuss signs, harbingers, biblical prophecy. It may just be the most contentious piece of literature in history, the book of Revelation, written by the Apostle John during his imprisonment on the island of Patmos. And contained within Revelation is a series of harbingers, warnings from God, called the Seven Trumpets. And according to Carl and other experts in Christian eschatology, five of those seven trumpets have already sounded, and the sixth may be very close at hand. If we're heading into the apocalypse, I'm hoping that Louis Armstrong will be the one tooting that final horn. First, do you remember a deliciously cheeseball low-budget movie back in the 1970s starring Ray Milland and ex-footballer Rosie Grier? It was called The Man with Two Heads. Now, here's where it gets interesting. In the movie, an avowed racist, played by Ray Milland, is diagnosed with some terminal disease and told his only chance of survival is an experimental procedure in which his head will be transplanted on a healthy body. When he awakes to his horror, he discovers his head has been transplanted onto the shoulders of a healthy African-American, played by, you guessed it, Rosie Grier. Now, had I been the producer, I would have had the two-headed man follow in Rosie Grier's footsteps, and the two-headed man would have been part of the real fearsome foursome that played with the Los Angeles Rams back in the 1960s. Now, here's the kicker. The idea of transplanting a human head onto another body, let me repeat that. I know it's sounding a little like Frankenstein here. We're taking a healthy head, removing it from a dying body, and attaching it or reattaching it to somebody else's body. It's very close to becoming reality. An Italian scientist, Dr. Sergio Canavero, believes he's come up with an outline to successfully complete the first human head transplant in history, which could lead to solutions for those suffering from muscular dystrophy, tetraplegics, and widespread organ failure. That conversation with the aforementioned Dr. Sergio Canavero awaits. This show is for baby Lily and all of those of you who believe in miracles. Never mind the debunkers or the naysayers. You're among friends. As far as I'm concerned, you've got a good head on your shoulders. I'm Richard Serrett. This is Coast to Coast AM. Hey, welcome back to Richard Serrett. Well, you know, it sounds like a science fiction novel come to life. One scientist says he is close to being able to affix one person's head to another human body. Italian neurosurgeon Sergio Canavero believes he's come up with an outline to successfully complete the first human head transplant in history, which could lead to solutions for those suffering from things like muscular dystrophy or widespread organ failure. Head transplants have been attempted since the 1950s when Russian scientist Vladimir Demikhov experimented with dogs. 20 years later, American neurosurgeon Robert White conducted a successful head transplant by moving the head of a rhesus monkey to the body of another. In fact, our webmaster, Sean Latisor, has posted that video up at coasttocoastam.com. Check that out. Now, the monkey lived for several days, but because Dr. White could not connect the two spinal cords, the monkey eventually died. Dr. Canavero describes in a recent paper a step to connect donor and recipient spinal cords. In other words, this is no longer an obstacle, fusing the spinal cords, no longer an obstacle. This is the one component that was missing from previous procedures because the technology to do so was not yet available. Quote, tomorrow is today, end quote, Canavero said in a recent interview. What was impossible can happen now. Dr. Sergio Canavero is with the Turin Italy Advanced Neuromodulation Group, and he joins us now by cell phone. Dr. Canavero, welcome to Coast to Coast. How are you, sir?
Oh, well, I'm totally fine. I'm so happy to be with you tonight, because actually it's morning here in Italy, but I'm really happy because this is really important that everybody just be apprised of what is going on here, because there has been voices out there from several critics, and so it's very good to be with you here, and just I want to take whatever question you might have about this.
Well, yes, let me assume the role just for a moment, and I'm guessing what some of the critics might be saying. I'm guessing that the term Frankenstein has been tossed around a little bit. Dr. Canavero, how do you feel about that?
Well, look, I just told basically everybody from all around the world that I just sit pretty with this term, because actually it's a way just to make this more palatable. You understand? I understand. Actually, Dr. White was called Dr. Frankenstein, and he even said that the critics didn't even read the book. But actually, Frankenstein is just a way just to soften up a little the sort of, you know, revolutionary surgery that just might come as a shock to society. So I had no problem at all with just being called Dr. Frankenstein. It's like, hey, Frankie, can you just give me a new head? Something like that. I have no problem. I'm totally comfortable with that.
Right. And I, you know, we understand that when people use that term, it's sort of short form. It's a way of, in a very short way, sort of suggesting, you know, why we're hesitant about this. And I can understand a little bit of this. You know, part of me thinks, wow, just because we can do this, should we do this? Why? Give me the argument for why we should be pushing ahead with this radical type of surgery, Dr. Canavero.
Look, I totally understand your question, and the answer came just exactly 1 week ago when we announced patient one, a Russian, 30-year-old, living near Moscow, was suffering such a horrible, crippling disorder. And all TV's just been flocking down to Russia just to film him. And he said, I just suffer from, I hope to have him in Annapolis in June just to talk to my colleagues and just make the case. But he said that, you know, I just been diagnosed with this horrible disorder. And the doctor said that by age 20, I would be dead. Now I'm 30. I can just barely move my hands, and I know I'm gonna die. I'm gonna die, and I want to do something about that. So my answer is, please go to any hospital in your neighborhood, in your city, go to any neurology ward, and ask to talk to this patient. Talk to this patient. Tetraplegics, muscular dystrophies. These are horrible disorders for which there is no cure. Let me say this very clearly. Western medicine has failed. For the past 20, 30 years, we just heard this talk of town as being gene therapy, stem cells, you know, the stuff. But where are they? You go wherever you go, these people are still dying. Gene therapy, as of now, has been pretty much ineffective for these disorders. Neurology is really in hot water, really in a fix, because they can't understand how this works. So they failed. So it's time to move on.
Dr. Canavero, but I mean, granted that fetal stem cell therapy, I think, has proven to be a dead end, but remarkable advancements have been made in adult stem cell therapy, wouldn't you say?
No, absolutely no. I totally disagree.
Okay.
I mean, when something works, it means that you go to a hospital, they diagnose something, and then you get whatever stem cell cure is out there. Right now, if you have Alzheimer's, if you have Parkinson, if you have whatever neurological condition you might just come up with, you go to any hospital and you don't get stem cells. Same goes, there are experiments, of course, but one thing is experimenting, and they've just been experimenting for years, and they're just wasted, you know, millions and millions of dollars, things like that. Then when after 20 years, when and I'm referring to gene therapy, after 20 years, I'm referring to stem cells because it's been 1998, so let's say more or less 20 years, let's say 15 years in the field of stem cells, and they failed. There's nothing to be seen there. So I just grew, you know, angry because people just come to you and just waiting for something to happen. They want to give in hope. And what kind of hope? Yes, in 50 years, we will cure you. We will be dead, but, you know, can't. But you mean we are not even able to cure metastatic cancer, terminal cancer. That's why Dr. White, the neurosurgeon referred to, who just performed the head swab in monkeys in 1970, just wanted to, he was a Catholic after all. He wanted just to help a friend of his who was just dying of cancer, but whose brain was totally unscathed by the cancer. So it means that after the Nixon, the Cancer Act, 1971, we're still there. If you have metastatic cancer, you're going to die. And all this ballyhoo about this gene therapy, you know, miraculous cures, every now and then you get drugs that just add another few months to your life.
Right.
If you're lucky, you know.
I get you. So if someone had terminal cancer and it had not metastasized to the point where the cancer had spread to the brain, you can take that still healthy head, place it on a new healthy body, and the cancer is in the old body. The cancer is gone. So
you're right. Sorry if I just cut in.
Yes.
You're totally right. The problem here is that there is a dearth of suitable donors, happily, because these are generally young people. So cancer, I was referring to cancer because that's what Dr. White had in his sights. But
right.
There is a dearth of donors. So this sort of extreme surgery should be reserved only for people with, you know, muscular dystrophies and tetraplegia, because they are not just leading you to straight to death fast. You're just going to be in that condition for years to come. So that's
so important. You would see limiting this type of surgery to people that have muscular dystrophy or other types of sort of neurological or paralysis, quadriplegics, that sort of thing. Okay, what has changed since Dr. White's, I don't want to call it a failed experiment on the rhesus monkey, but, you know, he transplanted the head of a rhesus monkey onto the body of another monkey, and the monkey died because that stumbling block, unable to fuse the two spines. What has changed that has you so optimistic that we are now on the precipice of being able to transplant heads onto other bodies?
Look, this is a very good question, and I want to answer in this way. First of all, I would not have just carried out that experiment because the monkey was in terrible pain. One of the major stumbling blocks along the way was that when you just, however minimally damagingly, you sever the spinal cord, you might get what is called central pain, which is a kind of horrible neuropathic pain. So the first stumbling block was just to find a solution for that problem. I did, and there was, you know, just tick off stumbling block number one. Stumbling block number two was, of course, to be able to reconnect the spinal cord. Now, I won't just delve into the technical details because they are a little bit complex, but I will just, you know, the lowdown. The lowdown is that, you know, all critics said that it is impossible to reconnect millions and millions of fibers, and that's wrong. That's wrong because, first of all, we understood that when you move, actually the movements are just a process. I'd like everybody, just allow for everybody to watch my TEDx talk available on the web because I make it very clearly. But first of all, there's been a change in the way we look at anatomy. So it's much easier to reconnect one part of the spinal cord, which is the central core made of cells, okay, which are actually the hub of this motricity omotricity. And so instead of just imagine spaghetti, as I referred to since I'm early, and if critics just consider this long spaghetti, if you just cut them, there is no way to reconnect them. But when I just made it clear that neurosurgeons already in the 50s had this wonderful, just, wow.
Dr. Canavero, let me. I apologize. I've got to interject here. We've got a break coming up. Let's just hold where you are. We'll come back on the other side and discuss further how we may be on the precipice of head transplants. Here's Hart taking us into the break with Magic Man right here on Coast to Coast AM. Where are you now, Kim Carnes? Of course, we all remember her monster hit, Betty Davis Eyes. But this is one that doesn't get as much airplay as it deserves. Crazy in the Night, which in my books makes Kim Carnes the muse of late night, overnight talk show hosts everywhere. We were just wrapping our heads around the idea of full face transplants. I think we're sort of kind of coming to terms with that. Do you remember that John Travolta, Nicolas Cage movie, Face Off? Well, that's becoming a reality. It's here. It's now. But now we're taking this a step further, a quantum leap. Head transplants. Dr. Sergio Canavero, an Italian neurosurgeon, joins us on the line. And he says about $30 million is all that's needed. And maybe within 2 years, we could be performing full head transplants. Obviously, this is fraught with many moral dilemmas. Who will be regulating this? Who will decide who gets a new head and who does not? We'll discuss further when Coast to Coast continues right after this. Dr. Sergio Canavero, Italian neurosurgeon, is with us here on Coast to Coast AM. Richard Serrett with you. Thanks for hanging out. Dr. Canavero, I was explaining or describing how we are about $30 million shy and about 2 years away from this becoming reality. Is that about right?
Oh, yeah, it's $13 million, actually, yeah. And look, you just mentioned that it is fraught with, ethical dilemmas and this and that. Now, I want to say this, and I want to make it clear. I'm talking to you as Americans, and this is very important. I want to make it absolutely clear that, you, America, just sent, men on the moon. They walked there, something that was totally considered totally impossible. That was the frontier. Now, space is not the final frontier, as every trek in the world knows. Actually, that's the brain. America has been shy of a frontier for too long. And head transplantation, just carrying out the first head transplant, is really the final frontier, because it will help a lot of people out there who are just living without hope. And second, as you know, the reason why this is ethically charged is that this is the first step towards life extension. Now,
yes,
this is
yes.
Absolutely true. I say that. Everybody, in his or her right mind would just catch on to it in no time. So this is about improving the lives in this century of basically everybody. So
well, could you, for example, excuse me, Dr. Canavero, sorry to interrupt,
yes.
But could you, for example, take the head of, I don't want to put it that way, that's kind of morbid. Let's say take a patient, we're not talking about a head, we are talking about a patient, a 70-year-old patient whose brain is healthy, who's, functioning, but his body is dying. Take the head of a 70-year-old patient and transplant it on the patient of, let's say, the body of a
20-year-old,
a 20-year-old, and then that person could live another 70 years. Is that possible?
That's the problem. It means that the technology, once we just do this on someone who really needs in a medical condition, then you move on to step number two, which is, of course, life extension. That is. So as you explained, you have this, you know, wealthy billionaire who is, you know, because the surgery initially will just cost, you know, to the nose. And so, and this billionaire would come to you and say, hey, I want to just add another 40 years to my life. And who will decide yes or no? Because, you know, there are doctors available out there to do whatever is needed. This must be a democratic process, because then you have to select who is going to benefit from this kind of surgery. Yes, I understand that it's awful, but that is the last frontier, because you start, you know, the first cars, they were really expensive. Then came Ford, and everybody has just the car. So you start with something which is, of course, experimental in the initial stages, and then you will improve the technique. You will just get it, you know, you will just streamline the procedure. All costs will just go down. So, I mean, don't be put off by the simple fact that it's costing a hell of a lot in the beginning. So we are looking for private sponsors. Yes, we are, because, you know, the NIH will never step forward with check, say, hey, you can do that, okay? That is not going to happen. So if you want to make this real, you have to contribute. I mean, that's why I like to talk to the people, not to the politicos,
right,
or, you know,
right,
the academia, because the academia is totally off the grid here. Because
right. Explain how... Sorry, paint me a mental picture of how this surgery would take place. And by the way, would you be performing this surgery? Do you see yourself performing the first ever head transplant?
If I'm – well, first of all, the Americans invited me over to Annapolis. And there, I hope just to convince them. And I'm pretty sure I stand good chances to do right there. I will just try to put together a team, a crew, okay, of course. But what I really have in mind is just to have American leadership for this sort of thing. You know, it's like, you know, sending someone to the moon, but instead of Neil Armstrong, you have Sergio Canavero. I mean, it's good, but it's Italian. I want this to be totally American, because this is really the last frontier. So it has to be someone from, you know, some surgeon from the United States. I will be there consulting. I am certified to operate in the United States, so no problem there. But okay. I really want somebody who is American just to do that. I want just
sure.
to consult, be there, things like that. And I want you to be convinced that this has to be done in America, because before everybody just, you know, just jumps out and say, oh, alarm, alarm, alarm. In China, okay, been studying Chinese for 4 years now. In China, they just performed the first full head swap in rats. Okay? I say again, in China, they just performed the first full head swap in rats.
Head swaps on rats. And these rats are not, and they are not paralyzed. They are fully functioning after the head swap.
Follow me.
Okay.
Follow me. They just performed the procedure in order to see if it worked. Then, right now, they're experimenting with the Gemini protocol I invented. Okay? So we are in contact. Why would I love for this to happen in America? Because there are, you know, stricter ethical, procedures which are, you know, available in your country. So, I mean, everybody can have his or her say. Everybody can just check what is going on and so on. China is good.
I understand. Okay.
You understand? So
I do. I do. But I would like. I would like. I would like to move on if I could, just because time is tight.
Please.
Could you paint a mental picture for us of how you foresee this surgery taking place? Let's say, for example, you've got the patient, you're going to do the head transplant, you've got the donor, you've got the healthy body. Mm-hmm. How does this happen? Especially the timing. The timing must be very precise here, obviously. So walk us through, if you could, as best you can, in short as time as possible, how the surgery would unfold.
Before the surgery, we must, of course, select the place. We must do this for the simple reason that we must obtain secure, informed consent from the community. Because if you get to have, some family member who was just involved in a car crash, gets to the hospital, is declared brain dead, then they will ask you to authorize, organ harvesting, or heart, and so on. So in that community, where this head transplant would just take place, you must secure, global consent from that community, so that if something happens, if some, young patient or whatever is just brought into the ER, instead of just organ harvesting, it will get his body harvested. So first of all, this is step number one. Step number two is that you need a huge surgical suite because it has to accommodate two surgical gurneys and two crews going about the surgery. Imagine that we will need about 100-150 personnel, including doctors, surgeons, anesthesiologists, nurses, technicians, just taking turns because the surgery will probably last about 36 hours. So we're talking about a huge hospital experienced in with several specialties available at hand on tap. So you have the neurosurgeons, the orthopedic surgeons, the vascular surgeons, the neck surgeons. So this is huge. This is really like a moonshot. You have to coordinate all these people. That's why I asked for 2 years. Not because I need more 2 years more of experimentation to do. That's because I had to coordinate and synchronize this huge number of surgeons and all. Then you go in. You just have served the recipient, the body recipient, and the body donor who is brain dead. At this point, the two crews will just start dissecting the tissues simultaneously, okay? And so this is why it has to be synchronized.
Sorry, when you say dissecting the tissues, you mean removing the head from the brain-dead patient and removing the head from the health the patient
that's alive? Yes, that's technical part, of course. That means just severing the muscles. And the last step will be just severing the vascular supply, that is the arteries and the veins, and the cord. This is the most critical step because it has to be done in a certain technical way, which I will just skip over. But simultaneously, you had just the same on the brain-dead body donor. At this point, when all is ready, you just remove the head from the brain dead body donor, okay? So the body is there, and you just start reattaching the head from the recipient.
Just like that. You make it sound so easy. Just like that.
No. Actually, look, there is nothing really, far out surgery. There is no far out surgery involved here. It is standard as far as the problem was the spinal cord, which I will just mention in a moment, but all the rest is actually, currently available surgical techniques, which are just brought to bear on the surgery. So there's nothing.
And the head of the head that's being reattached to the body, I mean, how is that brain preserved? Is it frozen?
The brain, very good point, the head of the body recipient will be cooled to about, I'm sorry, I don't use Fahrenheit, it is 10, 15 degrees Celsius, so it's pretty cold, in order to give us the time to reattach the vascular supply, the arteries and the veins. So I don't know the Fahrenheit, but it could be no. I don't know. Just make the calculation.
Well, I'm Canadian, so let me see here. I'm Canadian, so I know a little bit about metrics. So what's the degrees Celsius?
Celsius, it's very low. Your body temperature is 37 degrees. 37 degrees Celsius. So we are just more than halving that temperature, okay? So 37 degrees Celsius is your normal temperature.
Right. So 10 degrees is right. It's 40.
You do the math. Yeah. Okay, but that's not important.
But 72 degrees Fahrenheit. Got it.
Okay, so we cool the brain in order to protect it during the stage of reconnection. So at this point, you decool the brain, of course, and then you just move on to reattach whatever has to be reattached. At this point, as the very last step in the whole procedure, you just exploit this wonderful substances that are just, which are not glues, as the critic said. These are not glues. These are polymers that affect the fusion process between these fiber cells. Of course, there's much more involved there, but just to get you the idea, it is not a glue. Absolutely not. If you hear a critic say that it's a glue, it's not a glue. It just reconstitutes the nerve fibers. So,
all right, we're hearing you loud and clear on that. Let me ask you about this, Dr. Canavero. What about we hear often about, organ rejection. Is there any risk? I mean, we're talking about multiple organs, an entire body being attached to a head. Is there any risk of organ rejection in a situation like this?
Look, it's the other way around. It's the body that rejects the head, not the head that rejects the body.
Oh, really? Interesting. System. Interesting. Okay.
Yes. Yeah, I know. Look, it's pretty common. Hearing that the head rejects the body. No, the head cannot reject the body. Absolutely, it's the other way around, because the immune system. There is no immune system in the head. The immune system is in the body. Okay, so you mean the organs that just make the whole machinery. Immune machinery work is in the body. So now I'm asking you, you know that about 35 facial transplants have been performed, okay,
yes,
all over
yes.
the world. Okay,
and I'm
now,
just coming to terms
this.
With that. I'm just coming to terms with that.
No, look, imagine this, man. Then, since you are coming to terms, now I will just throw a little spanner in the works. What happens if a facial transplantee gets the new face rejected? No, don't answer. I will answer it for you. It's a mess because, all critics, including those who perform facial transplants, have not addressed the simple problem, the simple fact that if the body rejects the new face, hey, do you have a spare face somewhere in the fridge, in the hive box, just to go by in case of need? So, in these 35, more or less, cases of facial transplants, there has not been a single instance of full rejection. Yes, minor reaction, minor immune reactions, yes, but all controlled by just dosing up your pills. So,
okay, very quickly, we're almost out of time here, Dr. Canavero.
The problem is psychological rejection in case. But okay. Here we are just stepping the power of virtual reality. We will just train these people to just watch themselves for about 1 to 2 months in a new body.
All right. You have your patient in mind, correct?
Mm-hmm.
You have the patient. You have
Absolutely.
Patient zero in mind. Okay.
Yes.
And the idea is that
that's a Russian I was just referring to
right.
At the beginning. So
okay.
we have the list is very long. The list is very long, about 50 to 60 volunteers all lined up for this kind of surgery. And the problem is that several of these are transsexuals. So that's another pair of gloves. I would rather leave it, to the side.
Oh, interesting.
Right now.
Someone who wants a transsexual who wants their head placed on the body of the opposite sex. Interesting.
Oh, yeah,
okay.
The correct body, that is, because these people right. come with, the brain belonging to a gender and the body belonging to the opposite gender. So this
right.
is a pretty horrible condition. But, I'm sure that society here will have something to say. When it comes to, neurological conditions, I'm not going to take fire for that.
Understood. Dr. Canavero, as the date approaches, I mean, are you going to keep the location where the surgery, the hospital, et cetera, completely quiet in terms of, for security reasons?
Oh, this is a very, very good question. And I think this is part of the problem. When it comes to this, I'd really love for everybody to be informed. Because you had to go to the community, inform everybody. So
right.
I don't know that this is gonna happen. But if America says no to this, it will happen somewhere else, not
Got it.
By somebody else, and it will be totally secret.
Dr. Canavero, I appreciate you spending some time. This is fascinating, and I'd love to talk to you more about this, and perhaps we will. Can we, as the date approaches, continue to check in with you to find out, you know, exactly, you know, where you're at in terms of pulling this together? Are you good for that?
Absolutely, absolutely. And remember, okay, everybody, you can crowdfund. This is, sorry, I had to say this. If out there, there is someone who just wants to support this this mission, okay, pushing the frontier, they can contribute by buying my book on Amazon, and all the revenues will fund first crowdfunding in medical history this endeavor. So
thank you, Dr. Canavero. I appreciate it. Thank you so much. A Touch of Grey, The Grateful Dead, taking us into the break. On the other side, The Seven Trumpets with Pastor Carl Gallops. My name is Richard Serrett. You're listening to Coast to Coast.